now that my two sections are not at the same place anymore, I have to guess where we are. Is this right? Slide three?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, and I haven't talked about it yet, right?
No.
Okay, in the third slide, you can see there's an animal walking on water. You've probably seen something similar. And the feet of this animal, notice, look like they're deforming a skin on the water, like there's a skin that's holding this animal up. Well, it's pure water, of course, but it actually is a skin of sorts. And that's, once again, like all the other properties of water we're talking about in this chapter, due to hydrogen bonding. If you consider just a vessel of water, it's of course made up of quadrillions and quadrillions of water molecules. And as we've already discussed, all of those water molecules are polar, so they're all attracted to each other by hydrogen bonding. But the water molecules at depth, as opposed to at the surface, are all being tugged by other water molecules in all directions. Right? On the other hand, the water molecules that are on the surface are being pulled downward by the water molecules below them, but there's no water molecules above them pulling upward. So they're not being equally tugged in all directions. And that causes there to be a little bit of compression of the water molecules in those upper layers. And so it's a little bit more dense layer of water, just like a skin, compared to the water at the depth. And that's why this animal doesn't sink. In slide four, there's a couple things I need to mention that this map is a good example to explain. And the location of the map does not matter at all. This is not something peculiar about Southern California, but the main point of this map is that there's a large land mass next to a large water mass. And there's a couple definitions I need to give you along this slide. The first is a property that any given substance has, but the values for the property differ from substance to substance. And that first definition is the specific heat capacity. So you can measure the value for specific heat capacity for any given substance, including water, of course. But the definition, in general, of specific heat capacity is the energy that's required to raise the temperature of exactly 1 gram of that substance by exactly 1 Kelvin, or 1 degree centigrade. They're both the same size, so you could say it either way. The same size. By that I mean a Kelvin is the same size as a degree centigrade. Okay, so in general, that's what the specific heat capacity is. And you can think of it as a measure of how difficult or easy it is to heat something up or let it cool down. The higher the value for specific heat capacity, the harder it is to heat that stuff. Meaning you have to add more energy to heat it up the same amount as something that has a lower specific heat capacity. And compared to most substances, water has a higher specific heat capacity. Water has a higher specific heat capacity than land, than the soil in the land mass next to the ocean here. Now that has important biological implications. Because water has a high specific heat capacity, that means that even though both the water mass and the land mass are undergoing changes in temperature each day, because the sun isn't out continuously, right? The temperature is going to go up when the
the ocean or the continent is being irradiated when the sun is shining on it, but then it'll cool down at night. Well, they're both going to do this, ocean and land, but because water has a high specific heat capacity, it's harder to heat up and to cool down, and therefore it won't undergo a very high amplitude from day to day. The amplitude, when something oscillates like this, is just the difference between the highest point and the lowest point. At the same time, the land is going to undergo a greater amplitude, so it's going to get warmer during the day, and it's going to cool off more at night. In other words, compared to land, the ocean is a more thermally stable environment. And this is why, even though we tend to forget it as land-dwelling animals, life began in the oceans, not on land. And for most of the history of life, that's the only place there was any living things. It's only fairly recently, in the last 700 million years or so, that there's life on land. There were billions of years in which the only life was in the oceans, and that's where it started. And it started there because it's the most thermally stable place. So that's one important definition. Can you see this green? Is any better. The other definition that this map also pertains to is called the latent heat of vaporization. Just like specific heat capacity, any given substance has a latent heat of vaporization. It's a property. The value differs from substance to substance. And what the latent heat of vaporization is the amount of energy required to transform exactly 1 gram of that substance from liquid form to gaseous form. In other words, how much energy does it take to evaporate 1 gram of liquid of that stuff? And the value is different for different substances. Well, once again, compared to most substances, water has a high latent heat of vaporization, which means when you do evaporate water, that takes a lot of energy to do. Now, the high specific heat capacity is why if you are trying to boil water, for instance, that's the reasoning behind the old adage, a watched pot never boils, because it seems like if you're watching it, waiting on it to boil, it's taking forever. Of course, it will eventually boil. But the reason that it takes so long is because water's hard to heat up, and the reason that specific heat capacity is so high for water is because of its polarity. Think about what temperature is. Its temperature is a measure of the average speed of the particles, right? So to heat something up, meaning to raise its temperature, means you need to increase the average speed. You need to speed up the particles. Well, for a polar substance like water, before you can actually make them go faster, you first have to make those water molecules, you have to put a little bit of that energy into breaking the hydrogen bonds so that they can then go faster. And that's why it's harder to heat it up. Once you finally get to boiling point, then you're evaporating. And that evaporation, because water has a high latent heat of vaporization, requires a lot of energy as well. And as residents of the valley, we rely on this every day, especially in the summer, to keep us alive. We mammals have sweat glands. And sweat is not pure water, but it's mostly water. And evaporating it releases a lot of heat from our body, heat that would kill us otherwise. When water evaporates from liquid, from a sample of liquid, it not only cools the liquid that's left behind, But it also cools the air into which the evaporation is occurring. And that that might seem counterintuitive, but
let me explain why.
Thinking of this batch of water that I used earlier for the other definition. If there is a water molecule in this sample of liquid, and remember, liquid water is not chemically any different from gaseous water, right? Evaporation is just a physical change. You still have water molecules that are indiscernible from each other in both the liquid and the gas state. And it doesn't make sense to call one molecule a liquid or a gas. It's only for if you have a bunch of them together, how much they're spaced together matters. But this is a big population of water molecules in the liquid state at the moment. And if there are water molecules in there that are going to evaporate, that means going off on their own, right, into the air. So hopefully it makes sense that the only ones that have a chance of doing that at the moment are the ones that are at the surface. Now, any of them could eventually be at the surface because they're all moving around. But at this moment in time, a candidate for evaporating, a candidate molecule for evaporating would have to be at the surface, right? Does that make sense to you? Okay, well, what else would have to be true? If you think of it as likelihood, which kind of molecules? We're already assuming it's at the surface, because if it's at the depth, it's not going to be able to evaporate. It's just going to bounce around on other water molecules, in the liquid water molecules. But if it's at the surface, we're already assuming that, but there's trillions of them at the surface. Which ones are going to be the most likely to be able to escape? We're already assuming these are all at the surface. That's the only ones we're considering. Of the trillions that are just at the surface already, which ones will be most likely to escape? Well, how does a water molecule escape? Right, and goes off on its own. And so which ones would be most likely to do that? Well, we're already assuming all the ones on the edge. That, those are the only ones we're considering. If they're at depth, they're not going to have a chance.
Or landing like around the circumference?
Maybe, but that's not what I'm getting at. Don't overthink it. What has to be true of a molecule if it has a chance of going off of that surface? These are all moving. All water molecules in the liquid state are moving. Right? Right. The fastest ones among them have the greatest chance of escaping the pull from hydrogen bonding of the other water molecules left behind. The faster you are, the more likely it is that you'll be able to go off of that surface. That's evaporation. Okay, now consider what temperature is again. It's a measure of the average speed of the particles. So before any evaporation occurs, the average, you know, you could, if you were able to get in there and measure all of the individual speeds at the moment and then divide by the total number of water molecules, that would give you an indication of temperature. But the ones that are fastest are most likely to leave. So when evaporation occurs, you're getting rid of the fastest molecules in the sample, in the population of liquid molecules. And therefore, what is going to be the new average once those ones are gone? What's going to happen to the average? It's going to be lower because you've gotten rid of the fastest ones. And therefore, the lower average speed means it's colder. That's what temperature is. So that's why it cools the liquid that's left behind after evaporation occurs, and that's what keeps you alive, because the liquid sweat that you have on your skin becomes colder when it gets rid of some of its fastest water molecules as they evaporate, and that keeps you from overheating fatally. But I said it also cools the air into which the evaporation is occurring. And that's because even though it's the fastest ones from the liquid population that are escaping, the various molecules that are in the mixture of gases we call the air are going pretty fast. Which is why one reason why they're gas. And so a lot of those water molecules that are escaping the liquid are just barely escaping, and therefore their speed is actually below the speed of a lot of those air molecules, and so that brings the air average down, and so it cools the air as well. And this is exactly why an evaporative cooler, if you've ever had one in your house, works. It just pumps water continuously over material that is continuously being blown on by a fan. That fan helps some of that water, that liquid, evaporate, which cools the water, but that's really not what cools your house. It also cools the air that it's evaporating into, and that air that's now cooled is what gets pumped into your house. So it's beneficial in both ways. As far as the temperatures that are shown here are concerned, notice that this whole map is receiving the same amount of sunlight, same amount of energy being input to this. But as you've witnessed, I'm sure, if you've ever been to the coast, it's cooler temperatures right against the water. Well, that's because the ocean has a lot of water, of course, continuously evaporating. That's cooling that air, like I just said. And the land dwellers that are most exposed to that air, or they're exposed to it first, are the ones right at the edge. So the air temperatures are a lot cooler there. In slide 5, we need to discuss another remarkable property of water, once again explained by hydrogen bonding. But water, in the sense, in this picture, shows that water is pretty special with respect to the states of matter. We've been talking about matter states, gas, liquid, and solid, several times so far in this term. And for most substances in the world, the density, which is how much matter is in a given volume of that stuff, increases as you go from gas to liquid and then to solid. In other words, for almost all substances, the solid version is the most dense. It has the least space. The spacing between particles in a solid for a conventional substance is even closer than the spacing in a liquid. All right? But not for water. For water, the densest of the three states is the liquid state. And the solid state, solid water, which we commonly call ice, is actually less dense than water. Which you can easily prove to yourself by simply putting some ice cubes in a glass of ice, or in a glass of water. You have two states, right? Solid and liquid. Well, if water were a conventional substance, anything else but water, pretty much, you put solid chunks of that stuff into the liquid version of that same stuff, it will go right to the bottom because it's more dense than the liquid. But not water. Ice floats, in other words. And that's really important. We wouldn't exist if it weren't for this fact. Consider a body of water like the one you see in the middle of the picture. A lake or whatever. A lake is not pure water, of course, but it's mostly water. And seasonally, there's going to be pretty wide temperature changes. course, the coldest part of the year is winter. And so in the first winter, if you just think about successive winters, in the first winter, it'll get cold enough to freeze some of that water. Some of the liquid gets turned into ice. And if water were like other substances, that ice, no matter where it forms, would fall to the bottom. So there would be a layer of ice that accumulates on the bottom of the lake, and then there would be liquid above it. And being at the bottom of the lake, it is insulated, in a sense, from the input of energy from the sun, because it's blocked by that liquid. So in the spring thaw, when it comes, it'll get warm enough to melt some of that ice that accumulated in the winter, but not all of it. And then in the following winter, it'll get cold again and add more ice to the ice that's still there from the previous year. And the ice will get thicker and thicker until it's eventually a solid chunk of ice. And a solid lake of ice, no liquid in it at all, is much, much more difficult for things to live in, including things that are the ancestors to animals, including humans. That's why I say we wouldn't exist without the fact that ice floats. But ice does float, and the reason that solid water is less dense than liquid water is because of the geometry of the water molecule. The fact that it's polar, but also the geometry. We talked about why the angle between the hydrogens is where it is, right? Because of the tetrahedron that we talked about. Well, if you have liquid, like on the right cartoon, these water molecules are moving a little bit faster because they're at a higher temperature than the water, or than the ice. And so they are experiencing the same hydrogen bonds, but since they're moving faster, they kind of move past them. Like if you're moving magnets, get them close to each other, but you're moving them fast, you're going to feel a tug, but it's not going to keep it there in place. When you reduce the temperature, so you slow them down enough to make it ice, they're going to lock into place, swiveled into this arrangement so that all their hydrogen bonds are lined up. And because of that angle, it gives this kind of soccer ball arrangement, which is mostly space in between. So there's more space in ice between molecules than there is in water. And that's why ice floats. Not only does ice floating mean that in the winter there will still be liquid below it each year because the thaw will get rid of all the ice and you don't build up over years. Not only will there be liquid all year round for the things that live in that liquid to survive, but it actually makes it even easier for them to survive the winter because the ice will be an insulating layer between the water they live in and the very harsh air above it. Now, 6 is a cartoon representation of the fact that water is an excellent and versatile solvent. And remember, we talked about these definitions in the lab. The solvent is something that dissolves something else in a solution. Well, water doesn't dissolve just anything. There are things that don't dissolve in water. But there's a great many things that do dissolve in water, including ions, like we see here, or I should say, ionic compounds really get dissolved. What's another name for ionic compounds? Salts. This is the same salt we've been looking at, just one of many, many salts, but it's sodium chloride. And so someone has put some salt into the beaker, as you see here. It hasn't dissolved yet. This is still salt, which you see in cartoon form, the edge of the salt crystal right here. Many sodium and chloride ions hooked together by ionic bonds between them. Water molecules are pretty small because hydrogen is the smallest atom, and oxygen is not all that big either. And because water molecules are polar, like we've been talking about, they have partial charges. What is the partial charge on the oxygen?
Slightly negative.
Why negative?
The electrons from the hydrogen molecule—they spend most of the time there.
That's more time than not. Yes, but it's electrons from both oxygen and hydrogen because they're sharing them. That shared pair between oxygen and hydrogen spend more time around oxygen. Because of what? Why is it that they spend more time around oxygen? Right, because oxygen has a much bigger, much higher value of electronegativity than hydrogen does. So that's why water's polar once again. Now it's not fully charged like the ions are, but it's partially charged. And because it's small, it can get in there at the surface of the salt crystal and one by one pick off one ion, like this chloride ion that's just been picked off. And when it does, a whole group of water molecules will surround it, not just encircle it like you see in two dimensions here, but really it would be all the way around it, a shroud all the way around it. And they all swivel, all the water molecules swivel so that their partially positively charged hydrogens are attracted to this fully negative chloride ion. Right? It's a sheet of water around that chloride, keeping it from interacting with other ions. It's in solution at that point. And similarly, a sodium can be picked off. It's oppositely charged, but the water molecules just swivel the other way. So that their partially negative oxygen is in opposition to the fully positive sodium. One by one, all these ions will be picked apart. And at that point, even though we call this salt water, you really don't have salt at that moment. You have a solution of sodium ions and chloride ions. You no longer have sodium chloride. Unless you get rid of the water again and let the ions come back together. Now, the reason this is so important to biology is because life, as I keep saying, is metabolism. Is the set of reactions that are occurring in a cell. That's what the process we call life is. And more specifically than saying it's chemical reactions, the reactions that make up life are aqueous solution chemical reactions. They are chemistry that occur in aqueous solution, which means not only in a solution, but aqueous means that the solvent is specifically water. All right, that's the metabolism doesn't happen outside of cells. It happens inside of cells, and cells have a liquid interior that really is an aqueous solution. It's not just sodium chloride that's in there. There's a bunch of other solutes as well, but it's an aqueous solution. And 7 is kind of a continuation. Any salt will be able to be dissolved by water because water is polar and salts, by definition, are fully charged, right? They're ionic. But things don't have to be ions to be able to be dissolved by water. For instance, here we have lysozyme, and that specific example doesn't matter at all, but lysozyme is a protein. It's an example of a protein. And proteins in general are large molecules, they're macromolecules, that are made out of smaller subunits called amino acids that we'll study later. And there are different kinds of amino acids that can be hooked together, but some amino acids have a partial negative charge, some of them have a partial positive charge, and therefore the overall protein at the surface of it is going to have partial negatives and partial positives, like we see in the detail on the right here. It doesn't matter whether it's partially positive in that area or partially negative in that area. Water can still swivel appropriately so that its partially opposite charge is facing that partial charge on the protein. You can shroud the entire protein, and therefore it can be at least partially dissolved as well. You have a lot of plasma proteins, for instance. Those are just proteins that are carried in the liquid component of your blood. Blood's a tissue. It contains cells, but outside of that cells is extracellular matrix, which we call plasma, and that's mostly water dissolving a bunch of things that it's carrying. All right, eight. Now, eight is a chemical reaction. It's depicting a chemical reaction, but unlike the ones that we saw before with just a single arrow, notice the double arrow here, meaning that this is a reversible chemical reaction. It can go from left to right or from right to left. And notice that there's only water here on the left side, two normal water molecules. And they are turning into ions, as you see here, if you go from left to right. What's being depicted here is called the auto-ionization of water. Because auto means self. Auto-ionization means that water, just by itself, can turn into ions. And this happens for any given sample of pure water. But I'll talk in a minute about how easily it's able to happen. First, let's just see it happening. You have, on the left side, just this before the reaction occurs, the ionization, you have two ordinary water molecules. Of course, every water molecule is an oxygen covalently bonded to each of two hydrogens. So there's two single covalent bonds in a water molecule. And what's happening here is that the water molecule on the right of the left side, this one, is transferring not an entire hydrogen. You see that an H is appearing on this molecule, which started out as the leftmost. H, you're used to of thinking as a hydrogen atom, but it's not the entire hydrogen atom that's being transferred here. Now, when I say hydrogen atom, by the way, what do we have as far as subatomic particles are concerned in a complete hydrogen atom? What is a hydrogen atom? No, that's water. I'm saying one hydrogen atom is what in terms of subatomic particles? Well, orbitals aren't material. I'm saying subatomic particles. What makes up one hydrogen atom? First of all, what is it? What is the only thing that matters that makes it hydrogen to begin with? Well, not protons. Specifically, one proton. If it's any other number of protons, it's not hydrogen, right? It has atomic number one. So that's one of the subatomic particles, a proton. But what else does it have to be an atom? No, one electron. Because an atom is neutral, right? It has to have the same number of negatives as positive. Well, it has one positive, and therefore one negative electron. So that's what a whole hydrogen atom is, a proton and an electron. But not both of those are being transferred here. This second water molecule on the left is transferring just the proton of this hydrogen atom to the first water molecule, and that's what turns the first water molecule into what's called a hydronium ion. It has a positive overall charge because it's taking on this additional proton, but no electron as well. So now it has one more positive charge than it has negative charges. Is that clear why it's a positive charge overall? That's the hydronium ion, H3O+. Well, the one that lost that proton still has the electron from that original hydrogen ion, And it shouldn't surprise you that the electron stayed behind. Why shouldn't it surprise? Explain why the electron from the hydrogen atom stayed behind on this one. Why would it stick on to the water molecule it came from? That's part of it. But it's not a... What kind of covalent bond is it? What are the possibilities? What are the two categories of covalent bonds? Yeah. No, ionic is not a category of covalent bonds. Those are the two categories of chemical bonds. And by the way, the fact that you're looking at your notes means that you are not prepared for the upcoming test. And you need to realize that you have to tackle this stuff a little bit at a time each night. You're not going to be able to learn this all in one night before the test. So you should know this already, because we've already talked about it, and you therefore already should have listened to those recordings and studied those notes if you want to get through the course. And sounds like I'm bitching at you, I'm just telling you the truth. All right? The two kinds of covalent bonds are polar and nonpolar. What makes the bond in a water molecule polar? They're unequally shared, but why is it that they're unequally shared? Well, that's just a consequence of them being polar. Why is there... That's a consequence of them, of the sharing being unequal. Why is the sharing unequal? In any, not just water, but in any polar covalent bond. Yes, because there's difference in the values of electronegativity. Oxygen has a much higher electronegativity value, right? It's greedily attracting those electrons. That is the answer to my original question. That's why when the proton leaves, the electron stays behind. Because oxygen wants that very greedily. So it's only the proton that gets transferred to the other. Is that all making sense? And so both of these originally molecular water molecules are ions at this point. The one that received the proton is a hydronium ion, and the one that lost the proton is now a negatively charged ion since it has that electron still but no proton to counteract it. That's a hydroxide ion, OH negative. All right, now a hydronium ion does exist, but it can easily then just lose that proton to solution, the proton that it just received. So it can be just a proton by itself. And I want you to equate in your mind three different things. Proton, hydrogen ion, and the symbol H+. Those all mean exactly the same thing. A hydrogen ion, because hydrogen starts out as just a proton and electron, and remember, hydrogen is a non-metal. Non-metals make ions by losing electrons. So a hydrogen ion forms when a hydrogen atom loses the only electron it has. The only thing left behind is a proton. So when you read the word proton, think of hydrogen ion in your mind. And when you read the word hydrogen ion, realize that's just another name for a proton. And H+ is the symbol for both of those. And what I'm getting at is that you wouldn't even have to involve two water molecules. just one of them could lose a proton, and what you would have then is a hydrogen ion, that proton, H plus, in solution, and what's left of this, which would be the hydroxide ion, OH negative. And this happens when there is nothing but water there. But importantly, notice that when this autoionization happens, if there's any ion, if it does happen, you not only make a positive ion, you have to also make a negative ion. You can't make one without the other. Which means in water, pure water, there's always going to be exactly as many hydrogen ions as there are hydroxide ions. Does that make sense? Now, I said earlier that this happens to a certain extent in any sample of pure water. But, and it can happen at any given moment to any of the water molecules there, because they're all equal. But at any given instant, it's happening to a tiny fraction of the overall population. The vast majority of water in the sample, the water molecules in the sample, are going to remain at the moment as regular water molecules. Okay, now that's the autoionization, and that is important background information to understand what's shown in 9, which is the pH scale. And I'm sure that you've heard of the pH scale and maybe learned a little bit about it, and I'm sure you have you at least know that the pH scale probably is a measure of the degree of acidity of something. And that's all true, but I want to explain some things about the pH scale. One of which is that it is just one of many so-called P scales. The particular one that we call pH, the H of that name comes from hydrogen ion, H plus. Right? There's all kinds of other examples of P scales. And P scales are just invented by humans for convenience. When you are working with a lot of values that are small, it's just a pain in the ass to write 0.0000 a lot of times and then finally some non-zero number. So P scales are just a convenience to deal with those very small numbers. But were you taught that the pH scale is centered at 7? Did you ever learn that? Well, a lot of people, when they learn that, say, who came up with this? Why not just have the pH scale be 1 to 10 like we rate other things? Well, it's not that someone thought it was a good idea to center it on 7. That actually comes from water itself, a real property of water. So let me give you the actual mathematical definition of pH. It is the negative base 10 logarithm of the hydrogen ion concentration. Now, when you write something inside of square brackets in chemistry, that means the concentration of whatever is depicted inside the brackets. So brackets, H plus inside brackets, means the concentration of hydrogen ions. All right? But pH isn't the concentration. pH is the negative base 10 logarithm of that concentration. And you might have learned logarithms at multiple points in your academic career up to now, but most humans don't use logarithms day to day, so it's really easy to forget what they really mean. So let me give you a quick lesson on logarithms. There's infinitely many kinds of logarithms. Each kind has its own base. So there's the so-called natural logarithm that has E, the number E, as a base. That's not what we're using here. We're using the base 10 logarithm. And what the logarithm of some number X, X can be any number you want. If I ask you what the logarithm of X is, the base 10 log, It is the exponent that you have to raise the base, which is 10, to in order to equal x. Right? The log of a number is the number you have to raise 10 to in order to equal that number. So, for example, what is the base 10 log of 100? No, because 100 is not 10 raised to the 10th power. When I ask you what the log of 100 is, I'm asking you what do you have to raise 10 to in order to equal 100? 2, exactly. Because 100 equals 10 squared. And 10 is the base. The log is what you have to raise the base to equal the number. So what about 1,000? Right, the log of 1,000 is a 3. And what about 10? 1. What about 1? No? 0. Because any non-zero number raised to the 0 power is equal to 1. 10 to the 0 equals 1. Therefore, the log of 1 is 0. What about 1/10? No, 10 to the 0 does not equal 1/10. 1/10, which you can write as a fraction, or you can write it as 0.1, or you can write it as 1 times 10 to the negative 1, right? There, which is just 10 to the negative 1. So the log of 1/10 is negative 1. The log is always what you have to raise 10 to in order to equal that number. 1/100 is 0.01, but you could depict that as 10 to the negative 2. So the log of 1/100 is negative 2. Is that all clear? Okay. Now, when you actually take a real sample of pure water at standard conditions of temperature and pressure, and you actually measure the concentration of hydrogen ions in it, which would be bracket H plus, when you measure that value in pure water, it is equal to 10 to the negative 7th molar. As a concentration, molar is concentration, right? Okay, that's just the bracket H plus part. Look at the definition of pH, though. Never mind the negative. What is the log of 10 to the negative 7th? Negative 7, right. You have to raise 10 to the negative 7th in order for it to equal 10 to the negative 7th. That's what that really amounts to. So the log of 10 to the negative 7th is negative 7. But the pH is defined as the negative of the log. So the pH for water is the negative of negative 7, which is 7. That is why 7 is the center of the pH scale, not because someone thought it was a good idea. It comes straight from a real measurement of water that it's based on. All right, now, at that neutral pH, which 7 is, in pure water, there's the same amount, the same concentration of hydrogen ions as hydroxide ions, because you can't make one without the other if all you have is water to work with. That's when autoionization happens, you make each of them, right? So the concentrations will be equal. But not all solutions are neutral. A solution can be neutral, and a solution is not pure water, right? It's water and other stuff. It can be either acidic or basic, though. And another name for basic is alkaline. They both mean the same thing. Basic and alkaline are interchangeable words. But basic is one side of 7. Acidic is another side of 7, the other side of 7. And so you might have learned that not only is pH scale centered on 7, but the more acidic something is, the lower numerically the pH gets. And Here's why. It's, once again, it's because of the definition of pH. Water by itself has a hydrogen ion concentration of 10 to the negative 7th molar. Therefore, its pH is 7, right? Now, let's say that I add acid to it. And there's different ways of defining an acid that you'll learn in chemistry, but the first and most basic way of defining an acid is that an acid is a compound that contains hydrogen, but when you put that compound into water, it loses the it dissociates, and it loses the proton from the hydrogen that it has, and everything else is its own particle then. And so when you put that acid in water, you already have the hydrogen ions in that water due to water's autoionization, but now you're adding additional hydrogen ions from the acid. Okay? So an acidic solution has a higher hydrogen ion concentration than pure water does. That's just basically true for acidic solutions. Let's just say, though, that you increase the hydrogen ion concentration tenfold. What is 10 times higher than 10 to the negative 7th, which is what pure water would have? No? Remember, 10 to the negative 7th, if you write that conventionally, is 0.0000001. What is 10 times that? What is 10 times this number on the right? 10 times 100? Right? How do you do that? Start out with 100, you're just moving that decimal point one to the right. Yeah, so when you multiply this by 10, it turns into 0.00000, only 5 zeros, 1. In other words, 10 times 10 to the negative 7th is 10 to the negative 6th. And 10 times bigger than that would be 10 to the negative 5th. Is that all clear? Okay, let's talk about 10 to the negative 6th. If you've added acid so that you've multiplied the concentration of hydrogen ions by 10 and it's now 10 to the negative 6th molar, well, the log of 10 to the negative 6th is negative 6, and the negative of the log is therefore the negative of negative 6, which is 6. So increasing the concentration 10 times dropped the number from 7 to 6. That's why the more acidic a solution is, the lower numerically the pH value gets. Just because we based it on negative logs. Another really important thing to understand about the pH scale is that it is not a linear scale. You're used to using linear scales, like a ruler, for instance, or a meter stick. Those are linear because every unit on it is the same size as all, every step is the same size as all the other steps. That's a linear scale. Regular graph paper is linear in that respect. Each jump on a graph is the same as size as any other jump. But pH is not a linear scale, it is a logarithmic scale, which means that each step is 10 times bigger or smaller than the one above or below it, depending on which direction you go. Okay? And you can see that in this example. You increase the hydrogen ion concentration by 10 times and you go from a pH of 7 to a pH of 6. If you increase it 10 times again, that would be 10 to the negative 5th, so a pH of 5. But compared to 7, that's 100 times as much. So it's one step again from 7 to 6, or from 6 to 5, but from 7 to 5 is 100 times, not 20. Is that all clear? Okay. There's also nothing special about zero. Zero is not the limit. You can actually have a pH below zero. Zero simply would mean the hydrogen ion concentration is one molar, right? Because the pH would then be the negative of zero, which is zero. You can actually get below that. And you can get above 14. Those aren't the actual limits. It's just that almost all things are between those extremes. Well, the next slide, 10, shows you the same scale, but it places some familiar things that you might have around the house at various pHs, so you get an idea of how strong they are as either acids or bases. Notice that gastric juice, which is the stuff your stomach makes, is very acidic, pH of 2 or lower. And since it's a logarithmic scale, that means a jump from neutral water, which is 7, to 2. That's 5 steps. That's 5 orders of magnitude. In other words, that's 100,000 times as concentrated in hydrogen ions, your stomach acid, than pure water is. Because it's 5 orders of magnitude. 1 followed by 5 zeros. 100,000 times. Okay, now this is, pH is important for chemistry in general, but it's really important to biology, depicted in slide 11, for more than one reason, but there's one particular reason why it's so important that's illustrated here in 11. And that has to do with the fact that pH and temperature, although they are by no means the only variables in a cell, there's all kinds of other things that can vary within a cell, but pH and temperature are particularly important variables because they, even a small change in either pH or temperature can have a drastic effect on proteins. And we've already discussed proteins a little bit, enough to say that proteins are what give organisms their actual traits, right? Organisms are able to do what they're able to do because of their particular proteins that they're able to make. And so, as we'll discuss later, proteins have a huge variety of functions. Not a single protein. Any one protein has a function. But other proteins have other functions, and the reason that any given protein has the function that it does, the reason that it's able to do what it's able to do, is because it has a particular shape. Well, if you change the temperature or the pH, either direction, it changes the shape, which can also be called for proteins the conformation. Conformation is the shape of a protein. If you change the conformation, then the protein is no longer able to do its job. All right? Well, here we have the effect of changing pH. This is obviously a sick forest you're looking at, right? These are not healthy trees. And that's bad not only for the trees, but because trees are producers and all of the other organisms rely on them. The reason that it got into this shape is because of acid precipitation, which can be either acid rain, acid snow, acid sleet. Anything that falls as water from the sky is no longer pure water if there are pollutants in the atmosphere. For instance, sulfur-containing compounds that come from exhaust, especially of trucks. That sulfur reacts with water in rain or other precipitation and becomes sulfuric acid. So what falls on the forest is not water, it's an acidic solution. Changing the pH, therefore changing the shapes of the proteins in these plants, and those proteins lose their function, and the organisms can't live in those conditions. All right, that is that chapter.